Welcome to Crunching Tackles, where we break down the hardest-hitting social issues in sports. On today's show, two significant punishments have been handed down by the NFL, and we are here to talk about both of them, as well as several other sports stories that are happening right now. My name is Chad Wiley, and with me, as always, is John Nekrasov. And John, there is a lot of news happening this week that we got to get into, but first off, how are you?
There is so much news. Like, I'm looking at this rundown, and it's just, like, all lawsuits. Like,
yeah,
every single thing is legal action and people going to jail and assault charges and just like ugly stuff.
Honestly. Welcome to Crunching Tackles, where we talk about Supreme Court cases and other court cases.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I think that's kind of what we're here for, honestly. But we do want to start with some more lighthearted things as the goofy podcasters that we are. So we're going to talk about Adam Sandler because I just watched his new basketball movie. But first, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm actually really excited to talk about Hustle because this is a pop culture movie that is also about sports.
It is.
And it's almost more of a sports movie than any other sports movie because it actually fuses the culture of the sport with the movie better than most other movies do. And so I'm excited to talk about Hustle. I'm doing well. I know you have finished Peaky Blinders and I'm going at a much slower pace. But I'm gonna get there.
That's unheard of, honestly.
Yeah, I have a lot of other things going on in my life, but I'm gonna get there, John. I'm in season 5. I'm making my progress.
Nice. You're almost there.
Yeah, I'm almost there. Other than that, life is good. We're doing well. Happy to be on the podcast yet again.
Yeah, well, we're back here.
I'm not really thrilled by most of the topics we're talking about, but I'm happy to be here.
And we're talking about Hustle.
Yeah, first. So let's talk about Hustle. Hustle is Adam Sandler's direct to Netflix movie. Produced by, executive produced by LeBron James and Adam Sandler. It's a sports movie with Adam Sandler as a scout and wannabe coach for the Philadelphia 76ers. And that's all I'll say in terms of setup for the movie. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend checking it out. It's one of my favorite movies this year. It's one of my favorite sports movies I've seen in a long time. And I think we can get into why. But John, you've watched it more recently than I, and I think you liked it almost as much as I did. So I'm excited to hear what you think.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I'm not like, as much as I love sports, obviously, given that we're here, I don't necessarily always gravitate toward sport movies. So it kind of takes like a unique sports movie to make me like sit down and be like, all right, I'm going to sit down and watch this. But I don't know, something in my soul literally last night was like, you know what? I should watch this movie. Chad said I should watch this movie. So I'm gonna sit down and watch Adam Sandler. And it was a delightful movie. I had, as the kind of NBA novice that I am, had no idea who most of the people I was seeing were in terms of the actors that were actually all NBA stars. So that was super fun, honestly. And I just think Adam Sandler captured his role really well. I thought the rising NBA star, who turned out to actually be an NBA star apparently, did a great acting job. I was blown away. I had no idea that he was even a player. So,
yeah, it's. I think part of this is obviously the LeBron James effect as being an executive producer. But like I said, what this movie does is it's almost like they dropped Adam Sandler into like the real life NBA for a movie. Mm-hmm. Like one of the really cool things about it is the way that it fuses the actual NBA with the movie in a way that a lot of other sports movies just can't do. So if you think about something like Moneyball, which is a great sports movie, but pretty much everyone involved is actors. Like the baseball players are played by Chris Pratt and the people they're really like. So like any amount of actual baseball that they show is usually, you know, going to be lower quality because it's just actors. You know,
right.
Chris Pratt might have played Little League baseball, I don't know, but he's not an athlete. This movie, other than Adam Sandler, Queen Latifah, and the two people who own the 76ers in the movie, pretty much everyone else is an NBA personality or an NBA player, either playing a character or playing themselves. Like, the coach in the movie of the 76ers is Doc Rivers.
Right.
And other owners and former stars and current stars show up, including Kenny Smith, who's playing a character, Mark Cuban playing himself, Brad Stevens playing himself. Yeah, you know, Trae Young makes an appearance in this movie. The 76ers players like Matisse Thybulle and Seth Curry are in this movie. And then, like you mentioned, the two big performances are Hernacho Hernan Gomez playing Bo Cruz, who's kind of the protagonist, and he is awesome. Hernacho Hernan Gomez plays for the Toronto Raptors right now, and he's great in this movie. And then kind of the antagonist is this young draft prospect named Kermit, who is played by Anthony Edwards. And he is also really, really good in this movie. And it's fun to see athletes get a chance to just kind of have fun and do a basketball movie and be serious, but also have a lot of fun. And what happens ultimately is that the actual sports scenes in this movie look awesome.
They are incredible, genuinely. Like, I had so, like, I never even thought about it as being a movie because they were just, it just feels so realistic because I guess, you know, they were all actual NBA stars who are actually playing, so it checks out. But that, yeah, it was unreal. Some of the skills on display, I was like, whew, I was in awe just watching it in a movie.
I think it's one of Adam Sandler's better performances too, as he's kind of transitioned to a more serious actor. You know, he's balancing kind of some family responsibilities with his own personal ambitions, and then ultimately the bond that he forms with this Spanish player Bo Cruz. I love like how it infuses like social media and viral culture, as well as kind of like we always hear about these big like open gym NBA things, and sometimes we get highlights of them and a lot of times we don't, but that was a cool feature as well. It's just a really, really fun, you know, 2-hour film, and I would encourage anyone, whether you love basketball or just love a good sports movie, to check it out.
So out of curiosity, is that a thing that happens? I don't know. Those open gym things.
Oh, yeah.
Like, is that something that people do?
Okay. Yeah, that's part of, during the off season, those kind of things are happening kind of all the time.
Oh, interesting.
These players are working out with each other. These open gyms are happening. You know, I think this year LeBron was in a summer league, not the NBA summer league, but a different league that he's played in. DeMar DeRozan plays in these kind of like either exhibition matches or exhibition games or just open floor workouts are happening a lot in the off season.
Like to think of LeBron like showing up to his local YMCA for like
I love that
rec league. Can you imagine?
Yeah, and it my last on this is that it's clearly made by Adam Sandler, who loves basketball.
Right, like, of course.
He, you know, I thought of this because you mentioned like LeBron's open, like I believe that Adam Sandler like plays in NBA open floor game. Like he's also plays pickup basketball,
really?
And he's played with NBA players before.
That's incredible.
So he clearly is someone who is in tune with what the NBA is all about. And I'm glad, like you mentioned, that LeBron was part of this project. I wish it would have been cool if he was in it just a little bit, but it was nice that he was doing some behind the scenes work. I'm sure he helped facilitate a lot of the cameo performances.
Right. Yeah. It was interesting comparing this movie to Uncut Gems, Adam Sandler's other recent serious movie that I've seen, where he's also a basketball fanatic. And it was like a positive mirror image of that movie, which was super interesting.
Yeah.
Very different feels, obviously, but it was like it felt like I was seeing the same character at times, just like a good version of the same person, which was interesting.
Yeah, so Crunching Tackles stands Adam Sandler, and we recommends do. Hustle.
Yep, official seal of recommendation from both of us, which doesn't always happen.
John, you've got as we kind of transition to current events, you've got a Live Golf story here, but it's not the Live Golf story that I want to talk about. The Live Golf story I want to talk about is that we actually got the number of the offer that Tiger Woods was made.
Right.
And it was between $700 and $800 million to join Live that he turned down. And that's incredible that he would turn that down. I just love that for him. I love Tiger Woods. That's a really, really remarkable thing to do. And the fact that they offered that much money. Like is a photo op between Tiger Woods and Mohammed bin Salman worth $800 million? Apparently it is.
Which is stunning.
Yeah.
Given their all the kinds of things they're trying to do in the world, the fact they'd be willing to pay that much money to him is crazy. But yes, I also have a story related to them, and that is that 11 golfers, including Phil Mickelson and co, associated with LIV, have filed a lawsuit against the PGA Tour, essentially alleging that the PGA Tour, it's a, like an antitrust lawsuit, essentially alleging that the PGA Tour, by trying to stop them from playing the tour while moving to LIV, are basically trying to monopolize control of the game of golf. And this is basically them, you know, obviously trying to, you know, fight back against the PGA suspending them. And the PGA claims that basically they're trying to, having walked away from the league, get back into the league through lawsuit by forcing the tour to like let them back in. So, you know, I doubt this will go anywhere. But I don't know. I'm interested. I don't know how much you read about it, but I don't know what your thoughts are on that situation.
Yeah, I mean, this seems like a pretty frivolous lawsuit to me in two regards. First, because the PGA gave prior notice that this was a step right. that they were going to take. It was not like these players left and then the PGA Tour retroactively suspended them without notice. Every player who decided to join LIV knew in advance that this was going to be a consequence of their decision, and they chose to do it anyway. The second thing is that, like, the fact that LIV exists kind of proves that there isn't a monopoly in golf. Like,
right.
LIV is the alternative. LIV is the one of the reasons why the PGA Tour does not have a monopoly. But to say that, you know, this is essentially just the PGA, the former PGA Tour players trying to get the best of both worlds and, you know, the reality of, you know, life and capitalism kind of hitting them in the face, that your actions and your decisions actually do have consequences. And that's part of life. And I think that they just kind of want the best of both worlds. And this is seems like a kind of petulant way to try to get their way. And I would be surprised if this lawsuit was given any legal standing.
Yeah. The complaint says, for the New York Times, quote, "The tour's unlawful strategy has been both harmful to the players and successful in threatening LIV Golf's otherwise promising launch." And that, I don't know, that like, it's been harmful to the players in that they chose to go and do their own thing, but like, it seems self-inflicted. So I agree. I don't think this is going to go anywhere in particular, but it is an interesting, at least, attempt at trying to fight back.
Yeah. The second court case we want to talk about, John, this happened, we're recording this on Thursday afternoon, and this happened like an hour ago. This happened around noon on Thursday. This podcast will release on Friday, but so yesterday, Brittany Griner was sentenced to 9 years in prison by a Russian court. This was an expected thing. This isn't a surprise. And this is also kind of a prerequisite for any bargaining between the U.S. and Russia. Like, Russia kind of said, you know, in order for any sort of prisoner exchange to happen, this is kind of the first step. She has to be convicted and sentenced. It was a sentence that was roughly in kind of the range that people were expecting. Oftentimes, foreigners get more severe sentences than even Russian nationals in Russian court. So it is a severe sentence, 9 years for possession of hashish oil, but it also is kind of step A for a prisoner exchange that we talked about last week actually taking place.
Right, which was, I was reading, you know, in ESPN and the New York Times beforehand, that was kind of her strategy throughout the trial. It says that basically her goal was never really, since, because the Russian legal system, essentially if someone goes to trial, you almost will always be convicted. Her strategy from the beginning, once the trial started, was basically to admit guilt, say it was an honest mistake, let them, you know, give her whatever sentence they want, and then allow the, you know, prisoner exchange basically to go through. So that's basically been the strategy from the beginning, is just allowing the Russian legal system to run its course and then kind of rely on the US government to get her out. So I haven't heard anything new regarding negotiation progress, but hopefully this is kind of a step in at least advancing that forward a little bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, the initial contact between the diplomatic officials has been made. She's now been sentenced. So, you know, in terms of timeline, I would expect something to come through in August would kind of be my thinking. Would be if September hits and there's no new news, then that would kind of indicate that there has been a breakdown in communications between the two countries that is unexpected.
Right.
So this will be something that we'll continue to monitor in the next couple of weeks. And this is a story that I think we're committed to talking about kind of through the end here. So.
Yeah. Definitely. Hopefully it doesn't take too long. But
yeah.
So with these prisoner exchanges, as we've discussed, you know, sometimes even the negotiations, even when they kind of, when it's a foregone conclusion, it can still really drag on. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, John, our final transition here is to, really, it's been a bad week for the NFL.
It has been a awful week for the NFL.
Back-to-back mornings, these punishments have been handed down by the NFL to really influential people in the sport. We're going to talk about the second of those here in the current events topic. And this was the punishment handed down to the Miami Dolphins by the NFL for allegations of tampering The punishment is that the owner was suspended through October 17th and fined $1.5 million. The Dolphins lost a first-round draft pick. There were two complaints as part of this. First was tampering, and the second was tanking. Tampering being that they were improperly trying to get players to come while they were still under contract with another team. Tanking being that they were intentionally losing games on purpose. And the outcomes of both those investigations were different. John, if you want to kind of jump in and explain that.
Yeah, it's also important to note that this is a direct result, as far as I understand, of the Brian Flores lawsuit involving, you know, his various allegations against the Dolphins organization. Mm-hmm. He basically said that Ross, in his lawsuit, he said that Ross offered, I think it was $100,000 a game
to lose
games in relation to the tanking, and also alleged that the organization was trying to tamper with both Tom Brady's contract while he was at the New England Patriots and with Coach Sean Payton's contract while he was at the Saints before he retired. And so this essentially the findings were that the NFL found that there wasn't enough evidence that Ross was actually serious, even if he did say things about giving money for tanking, that it was not actually like a serious offer, was basically what their conclusion was. So they didn't follow through on that one. But the tampering case was very much found to be true. That was very much corroborated with all the evidence that the NFL found. And then after a 6-month investigation, handed down the penalties that you just talked about, which is unprecedented, was what Goodell called it in his report. That there's never been a tampering situation in the league on the level of this situation with such high profile players and coaches and with such a serious situation. So obviously Dolphins owner said he disagrees with the conclusions and the punishment, but there will be no appeal process. So the situation sounds pretty done.
Yeah, I think, and Brian Flores also released a statement saying that he was happy in part and disappointed in part because, mm-hmm. you know, part of his allegations were confirmed. But I think the biggest thing for him personally was that $100,000 that he alleged. And the investigation said that they did not find that. They did find that Stephen Ross kind of insinuated that, you know, just kind of created a culture where it's kind of seemed like he didn't care if they lost games. Mm-hmm. And maybe he even said something to that effect as a joke. But they did not find that he was serious, and they also did not find that an owner really can have control over whether a team loses games. It kind of seemed like he was insinuating that he didn't mind if they lost, but ultimately, like, he didn't have the power to control whether or not that happened. Mm-hmm. It was interesting, too, that the investigation specifically mentioned the end of the season when Ryan Fitzpatrick won a couple late games for them against the Patriots and someone else. And they won like two or three, and the Bengals to get one pick. Yeah. Beat the Patriots and the Bengals. And the Bengals ended up getting Joe Burrow with the number one overall pick. And they cited that as an example that the team was, in fact, competing and trying hard and were not blatantly tanking.
Well, like, it's like the infamous Jets game, I think it was the Jets a year or two ago where they won their last game of the season or something, and like fans were in an absolute uproar. So what's interesting about this whole, I don't know, talking about the tanking, like focusing on the tanking for a little bit, because the tampering seems like relatively clear cut. They did it. They have been penalized for it.
Yeah.
The tanking is interesting, you know, because we talked last week about match fixing and all that. And tanking is very much, you know, in a sense, it's a form of match fixing. It's in the same kind of family if you are actually trying to tank and actively trying to lose games. But it seems, in the way people talk about it, that it's actually relatively common, potentially, in the way that some leagues seem to function. Not that necessarily they're actually actively trying to lose, but that they're at least not trying that hard to win. I feel like we've seen that with teams toward the bottom of leagues before. I don't know, like, I'm curious. I don't know, I guess it's just interesting to have this kind of situation where the league's investigating potentially punishing a team for that when it seems like it's a relatively common thing that, like the Sixers, like it's been discussed, the Sixers have done, you know, that rebuilds often end up with teams really seeming to kind of tail off toward the end of a season to try to get draft picks.
Yeah, I think it's more blatant, even more so than in the NFL and other sports like baseball, where like
right.
one of the like the biggest thing about like every time the trade deadline in MLB comes around, the question is, okay, who are the buyers and who are the sellers? And the insinuation is that some teams are trying to win now and they are the buyers, and they are mm-hmm. trying to buy the good players from the bad teams who are the sellers, who are trying to get assets for the future. You know, and it's very like blatantly obvious that that's happening every MLB season. You know,
right.
the Nationals are a seller and the Padres are a buyer. And so Juan Soto goes to the Padres and the Nationals get a bunch of prospects who will matter in 5 or 6 years when the Nationals think that they can be good again. That happens all the time. You know, and it can happen. And you, there are also ways that you can tank without it really being obvious. You can,
right.
you know, say someone's injured, you know, like, oh, some star player has a undisclosed injury and will be out for a while and you lose a few games. You know, so there, but I think what the NFL is trying to crack down on is, you know, in baseball, like, you can manipulate the roster so that the roster is intentionally not competitive. Mm-hmm. And you know that in the grand scheme of things, you're going to lose more games than you win. Like, you can kind of guess what your win total is going to be. But there's a right. difference between assembly of roster and, like, actively trying to lose an individual, a specific right. game, right?
Right, right.
Like, the Nationals are not going to not play hard. They're just not going to be a good team, right? But there's right. not pitchers going to be intentionally throwing balls or batters intentionally striking out. That's just not going to happen. And
right.
in football, that's the same thing, right? If Brian Flores was deliberately losing games through bad play calling or through holding out a healthy star player or in any other means, that would be significant. But that's not really what's happening. Not having a competitive roster is not tampering necessarily, I don't think.
Right. Okay. I think I'm tracking with you in that kind of situation. And I think this would be serious, obviously, if money was actually offered
yeah.
to players and coaches to lose a game, because that you know is very similar to what we talked about last week with being offered money by, you know, crime organizations to lose games. You know, you're doing it for your own team in that regard, but it's still, you're still attempting to alter the outcome, the natural outcome of a game, for an outside reason, which in that circumstance I definitely think would be punishable. But I do think it's interesting seeing kind of like where like the invisible lines are for like what is like acceptable behavior in this regard, because it yeah. does, like, it definitely doesn't seem like a clear cut kind of situation to me. I guess just the whole issue of tanking.
Yeah. A couple interesting thoughts on the tampering before we transition is just mm-hmm. first, apparently, according to the investigation, part of the offer to Tom Brady was giving him ownership stakes. Mm-hmm. Which I don't think that has happened in the NFL before, that someone has tried to give an active player an ownership stake in a team as part of their decision to come play for them. So that's interesting as terms of just, is that eventually going to happen? We've seen, you know, active players invest in teams in other leagues, other sports. But this would be the first example where I think an American athlete was offered an ownership interest as part of being on the roster in at least my lifetime. That hasn't really happened.
I thought it was interesting, actually, that the whole like tampering laws was actually part of league rules.
Mm-hmm.
That was not something I actually even knew was a thing. I kind of assumed that you could at least talk, obviously not about like breaking your contract necessarily, but I kind of assumed that happened since you can be bought out of your contract, that you would be able to talk to other teams while you were in contract, but I guess that's not the case.
Yeah, I guess not. As we transition, John, my last thought is, this is a stat I told you about earlier, but in the NFL history, there have been 3 instances in which a team has been forced to lose a draft pick as part of a punishment. Mm-hmm. And in every single case, the team and the punishment has in some way involved Tom Brady. The first was Spygate with the Patriots. The second was Deflategate with the Patriots. And now we have Tampergate with the Dolphins. So I think it's interesting how Tom Brady is like undisputedly the greatest football player of all time, but he's also like one of the more embroiled in scandal football players of all time. And
Very
that's a fascinating and often overlooked part of his legacy. But I think that stat is really, really funny.
Can we just talk about the fact that he's playing again this year for a minute before we move on?
Sure. Yeah. What do you have to say?
I just the fact that he's playing again is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't feel like we adequately have reflected on the fact that he, like, retired, then said he was not retiring, then announced that he was retiring, and then unretired.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I still don't understand why any of that process happened. You know what I mean? Like, he clearly wanted to play, and he had statistically the best season of his career last year. So if he felt that way, why did he decide to retire? Like, I don't understand.
Do you think
any
that he
that
seriously
situation.
Wanted to play?
You think
like,
he didn't?
Do you think that he was like being forced to retire by someone else?
No.
Like, I think he genuinely thought retirement was right for him, and then regretted it. Like, I think he genuinely thought that he wanted to be done, spent some time at home, and was like, "Oh, I must hate this." Or so, I don't know.
He
that's
just
a joke.
Hates his children.
But no.
Which was what all the memes said right afterward.
I'm not saying that. I think that he did retire in good faith.
You really think he did?
And I do, and I think he regretted it. That's what I think.
Which is, if that's true, if we give Tom Brady complete good faith argument and he's not just being a diva, I think that's hilarious. Because he literally, it was a month. It wasn't like half a year. It wasn't a year. He was at home for a month and he said, you know what? Never mind.
My favorite part of the story is that he goes to see Cristiano Ronaldo play for Manchester United, another, you know,
that's
aging
right.
superstar. And then Cristiano Ronaldo scores a hat trick. Mm-hmm. And then there's a video, apparently, of Cristiano Ronaldo asking him, are you really retired? And Brady kind of shrugs and doesn't really answer. And then, like, it was within, like, a week or two that he unretired.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I love the idea that seeing Cristiano Ronaldo perform well at age, like, 37 or whatever was part of the inspiration for Brady to be like, you know what? I think I can still do this at age 45.
I hope it's true. The fact, I mean, he's so old.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's, like, for a football player, that's, like, that's ancient.
Yeah, ancient.
Ancient. And he's still, like, not at the top of his game, obviously, but, like, he's not that far away from it.
Yeah, if you want to hear more about this, we did a podcast about age in sports.
We did.
A while ago.
About that.
Some of the examples of the oldest players to play professional sports. Go ahead and check that out. John, any other thoughts on the current event before we kind of transition to the biggest story this week?
Now we can move over.
Okay. So more NFL punishments coming up on the other side of the break, and we're going to talk about the Deshaun Watson suspension. So don't go anywhere, and we'll be right back. And we are back on Crunching Tackles. And John, the day before the NFL handed out the suspension to the Dolphins, they handed out a ruling. Well, I guess the NFL didn't. The decision by the neutral arbiter was announced on, was it Tuesday this week or Monday? It was early this week. It was Monday this week. And the arbiter, a judge named Sue L. Robinson, who's a former federal judge who is now working with the NFL to decide these kind of cases, her ultimate conclusion was that Deshaun Watson should be suspended 6 games after the NFL made their case that he should be suspended for a year. And the player and the representatives for Deshaun Watson argued that it should be 4 to 6 games. And so she came out on the 6 games end of the spectrum. She gave a rationale in a 16-page ruling that we're going to get into. We've talked about the story before, John. I don't even know kind of where to begin to tackle this story, because this is just, there's just so many different elements to this, from the, you know, moral bankruptcy of the Browns to, you know, the actual guilt and punishment to Deshaun Watson. And then there's also the whole procedural element of this, and hovering over it all is how this impacts the image of the NFL as people kind of look to the inconsistency in punishment for different types of offenses. Mm-hmm. I threw out a lot there. What do you want to pick up there first?
Yeah, I think let's start with the kind of the legal bare bones of what's going on, I think, and we can kind of work our way around through how the procedure is operating right now, I think. What's significant about this, just in terms of NFL discipline, right, is that this is you know, I was trying to wrap my mind around, understand what exactly was going on last week as this all was kind of unfolding, because, you know, the two grand juries refused to indict him on criminal charges in relation to all these sexual assault cases that were brought against him by, I believe, was it 24?
24 women.
24 women. The vast majority of them have already been settled. I think one may still be outstanding, but I know that three more were just settled recently. So, you know, most of these, in terms of the criminal side of things, have already kind of been, quote unquote, resolved. So all of this is happening right now is within the NFL's kind of disciplinary system, rather than anything to do with the U.S. legal system, assuming that Deshaun Watson doesn't like sue the NFL or something like that. So what this is the NFL ruling on whether Deshaun Watson has violated the league's policy, like conduct policy for its players. Previously, these kind of cases, and we'll get into this, were largely ruled on by Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner. This is the first suspension that has been done by a independent arbiter that was basically a new process that was kind of negotiated with the players union over the last few years. So this is kind of not necessarily a trial run, but is kind of the first high profile usage of this new system that's kind of designed to stop Goodell from basically having all this power to himself for determining the future of players. This situation, I guess in my mind, you can jump in here wherever you want, is a little bit complex for a couple reasons. One, that, you know, this power was given to the arbiter to decide this, but after her decision, everything kind of came down to whether the NFL, which asked for a year suspension, would appeal her decision. And that would then put basically the final decision back in the hands of Roger Goodell, who could then do basically whatever he wanted. So though she kind of made her ruling, the CBA still gives the power for Goodell to decide an appeal. So the important news next is that the NFL did in fact appeal yesterday. So this is now going to go into the hands of Goodell to decide the situation. So this is not very much not the final decision of the NFL, the 6-game suspension, but we are on the way toward that process, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think the simplest way to think of it is to think of the independent arbiter's decision as more so of a recommendation that the NFL could choose to accept and Goodell could accept, or they could choose to appeal, and that puts the power back into the hands of Roger Goodell, who ultimately is still the enforcer and the executor of punishments by the NFL. I think I want to kind of, you kind of laid out the appeal. I don't need to get into that. We don't know what's going to happen other than that the league is continuing to insist on a much more severe financial penalty in addition to an entire indefinite suspension with a maximum of a year. So,
right.
I do want to talk a little bit about Sue Robinson's decision. In her report, she cited that she, you know, looked at it in comparison to recent precedent. Obviously, that would include, I think the biggest comp would be the Ezekiel Elliott suspension for domestic violence. Before that would have been the Ray Rice and Greg Hardy domestic violence suspensions as well. But she also mentioned, and part of the reason for her ruling being 6 games was that she felt like the NFL was retroactively applying a new standard to Deshaun Watson that should not, without giving him proper notice. So they're saying that because the NFL changed the system, the tiers of punishment, and didn't notify the players in advance, they can't then retroactively apply the new standard to not crimes, but incidents that happened while the old standard was still in effect, basically. And that's true, you know, that is also applied in the American criminal justice system, where like if you make something a crime, you can't then go punish people who did that crime in the past. It starts when it starts. Right. The NFL is saying, no, you know, this is unprecedented and we need to set a new precedent with this case. And the judge did acknowledge that this was an egregious wrongdoing by Deshaun Watson, that it is unprecedented in the NFL. She acknowledged those things, But those were kind of her reasonings for the six games. I think to me, obviously to the NFL and to most fans, that six games seems incredibly light. And I think that kind of leads us into the kind of the notable comparisons and why this does not seem like actual justice.
Yeah, I mean, we talked numerous times in the aftermath of this decision or recommendation about using Calvin Ridley as an example, who was banned for an entire NFL season for gambling, like we talked about last week, you know, on teams that weren't even his team, right?
I was wrong last week. He did bet on his own team. I looked that up. We were talking about gambling last week, and I said that he did not bet on his own team, and that was incorrect. So I just wanted to clarify that.
So he was not playing.
That's correct. Right? He was not on the active roster.
He had insider information on his team, but that's was correct. Not actually playing. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Regardless, 16 games for betting. DeAndre Hopkins had 6 games for PEDs. Tom Brady had 4 games for Deflategate. In the closest comparison, Ezekiel Elliott, like you just mentioned, had 6 games for domestic violence. And when you put that into comparison to Deshaun Watson's case, which is, you know, 24 women over multiple instances, you know, it does feel, the judge mentioned it being a kind of like a first offense, but it does still seem like it's so many situations that it seems very disproportionate.
Yeah, and just to clarify, even like the 6 games that, you know, DeAndre Hopkins, or especially the 6 games that Ezekiel Elliott got, even that is in many ways a more severe punishment than what Deshaun Watson got because they added a game to the regular season. So that's actually the suspension that Ezekiel Elliott got was a higher percentage of the total games in a season because it was 6 out of 16 games. Now mm-hmm. it's 6 out of 17 games, so it's even less severe of a punishment than what Ezekiel Elliott got if you look at it as a percentage of the season that he will miss.
Yeah, I know, maybe you can speak to this. I'm in terms of how legal precedent situations like this works, it seems to me, at least in my mind, strange that she would not be willing to recommend a punishment higher than other previous situations like this, when it seems like it's such an egregious offense, right? And she said, like I was saying a minute ago, she said that she was treating it basically as a first-time offense, even though he did it so many times. And as she mentioned, is completely unrepentant about it and basically said he did nothing wrong and sees nothing wrong with his behavior, right? Like, I feel like that has to be factored into, you know, when, even if it is nonviolent sexual assault, regardless, you know, it's still the amount of times that he did it, I feel like has to factor into it not being a quote unquote first time offense, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Ultimately it's really difficult to kind of compare immoral actions. So, right. So like does 24 nonviolent examples of sexual misconduct equate to one example of violent abuse? Like there's just no really good way to compare that. Right. She did, one of the factors that she mentioned was the fact that it was nonviolent as mm-hmm. probably yeah. part of why the suspension was so little. I completely disagree. I think that this is the worst personal conduct behavior committed by an NFL player on record. Mm-hmm.
Which is what the NFL said.
Yeah, and I do believe that they should reset the standard for punishment based on this. You know, if you believe that Deshaun Watson did it, or I'm sorry, if you don't believe that he did it, then he should get 0 games. And if right. you believe that he did it, he should get the most games and the most severe fine in NFL history, in my opinion.
That's not even a question.
Yeah, they should reset the standard for what punishment is for a player in the NFL. And they seem to have different policies for different things. Like, they punish integrity of the game issues, which would have been the Tom Brady, the Deflategate, that would include Calvin Ridley gambling suspension, mm-hmm. on a completely different criteria than they do PEDs and drug use, which would be Josh Gordon and DeAndre Hopkins. And then they could handle that completely separately from personal conduct, which would be Ezekiel Elliott, Ray Rice, and Deshaun Watson and sexual misconduct. And I can't morally come to grips with the idea that using a performance-enhancing drug is equally severe to abusing 24 massage therapists and being, you know, found guilty of it by the independent arbiter. Like, I, again, when you're comparing integrity of the game and performance enhancing drugs or drug use to violent or nonviolent sexual misconduct and abuse, the personal conduct policy, particularly in those instances, should be the most severe kind of punishment. Because it's how like self-important do you have to feel to say that the integrity of the game, the fact that Calvin Ridley gambled on sports, is more important than what this player was doing to these women, 24 of them, over the course of months, and being a predator to women. And they're going to say that that's less important than someone who ruined the integrity of our beloved game. This guy ruined the lives of women.
Mm-hmm.
How much more important is that than the integrity of your game? It's ridiculous.
No, I think that's really well said. Very well said. And I think, you know, if the NFL is going to come out here and say, we, since the criminal courts didn't have enough evidence to find him guilty, we, you know, though it may seem suspect, we don't think there's enough evidence for us to suspend him. We're moving on with the situation. I think that's one thing. I think that would be bad, but, you know, it would be a consistent position. The NFL has basically said there's enough evidence to say that he has committed these actions. And given that they have admitted that, I 100% agree. I don't know how you can possibly come to any conclusion other than, you know, almost, you know, an indefinite ban, I think, is almost the right decision. Like, I seriously question whether he should be allowed to play football again.
I was about to be honest. Yeah, I was about to say, John, that if an owner was found guilty of doing this, there would be a conversation about if he should be forced to sell the team and just be out of the league entirely, like Donald Sterling in the NBA. That would be the conversation.
Well, I mean, there was the whole Robert Kraft situation. That did happen.
Right. I think that you mentioned that, you know, they obviously believe that Deshaun Watson did it, and that's true. And I don't really, I don't think what the criminal court found in this case is particularly relevant. And it's also because, you know, that's a different standard than what the NFL is using.
Mm-hmm.
It's also worth noting, and this is kind of circumstantial stuff. It's not hard evidence, but Deshaun Watson is not behaving like an innocent person.
No, not at all.
He has settled every lawsuit but one. And the reason why you settle a lawsuit is because you're trying to prevent the discovery phase, which is when evidence is brought and, you know,
right,
cell phone records are turned over. And the reason why you settle is because you don't want that to happen. And so, obviously he doesn't. He also is not, like, defending himself. Like whatever you think about Trevor Bauer is behaving like someone who believes he is innocent. He is counter-suing women for libel. He is, like, filing lawsuits against media organizations for defamation. He's getting injunctions in court to defend himself. He's behaving like someone who is innocent. Even like a recent celebrity example is someone like Amber Heard in the Johnny Depp trial. She lost her case, and the day she lost the case, she came out with a statement saying, "I'm incredibly disappointed. We're going to be looking for avenues to appeal. You know, this was a wrong decision." And Deshaun Watson hasn't even released a statement since the decision came out. His attorneys have not released a statement since the decision came out.
No comments whatsoever.
He is not behaving like someone who is innocent or who believes that they are innocent. And to me, like, that's all I need to see.
Yeah, I think the court of public opinion has already decided, you know, this is not like a controversial situation, right? In terms of like, is Deshaun Watson guilty? I don't think I've heard a single person say, oh, we need to hear Deshaun Watson's point of view here. You know, like the amount of accusations that have come through, right, in detail with corroboration, as Robinson said, you know, with some of them, you know, some of them haven't been as well corroborated, but there have been at least a few that have enough corroboration that she said, you know what, it's going to be very difficult to disprove this, you know, and this is coming from the person who gave him a 6-game suspension, right? So I don't know. I think you're right. And I think this then leads us on to one of the points that bothers me the most, which is the organizational culture of the Cleveland Browns that are willing to give him that much money.
Yeah, before we do his current team, I want to talk about two teams. I want to talk about his former team first. Okay. Because the Texans have also settled over 24 lawsuits in this case. Right. And according to most reports, the in-house attorney for the Houston Texans was putting non-disclosure agreements, printed out non-disclosure agreements in Deshaun Watson's locker room for him to give to massage therapists before they gave him a massage.
Are you serious?
Yes. So, like, where is the accountability for the Texans? If their on-the-payroll attorney is at least somewhat aware that Deshaun Watson needs non-disclosure agreements for his at-home massages.
I mean, that's just an atrocity. So do we know, is there any kind of legal repercussions for the Texans that we know of right now?
Other than the fact that they've been also sued by every single woman and have settled every single lawsuit. So they have paid financially to women for their negligence or their wanton behavior. I'm surprised that there has not been an NFL punishment for them as well. That does surprise me because, you know, he was on their team when this behavior was happening. And it seems like people were aware and even involved in facilitating this sexual assault. But I do think the Browns are the bigger point because they're the ones who have not only, you know, taken this scandal on in terms of putting him on the roster, but have made him the highest paid NFL player in history based on guaranteed income.
Yep, $230 million.
Who have continued to stand by him throughout this entire process, who have, you know, deflected or ignored any questions, who have refused to answer if they even interviewed any of the women who have accused Deshaun Watson of assault before bringing him onto their roster, and who have stood by him at every single step along the way. Presumably, if the appeal does not happen, Deshaun Watson is going to be the Week 7 quarterback for the Cleveland Browns. And that is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, so Browns owners, quoting an ESPN, Dee and Jimmy Haslam said in a statement Monday, you know, Watson has not put out any statements, but the Browns owners did. We respect Judge Robinson's decision. At the same time, empathize and understand. Listen to this. That there have been many individuals triggered throughout this process. Like, triggered. I have a lot of words that I'm not going to say on air triggered about that statement. But triggered is the word you're going to use. You're going to put out a statement. And you're going to say individuals triggered by the situation. We know Deshaun, continuing the quote, is remorseful that this situation has caused much heartache to many. And he will continue the work needed to show who he is on and off the field. And we will continue to support him.
It's not just the support that's interesting in that quote. It's the fact that they say we know Deshaun Watson is remorseful when Deshaun Watson has shown zero examples of remorse. And part of Judge Robinson's report was that he was not remorseful.
He has denied all wrongdoing and said he has no regrets for any of his actions during the massage sessions.
And so are the owners. Why are they saying that he's remorseful? When has he demonstrated any remorse?
It's an atrocity. And the fact that the Browns, again, I'm going to say it again, and they have a track record for this. And this is why I was a joke Browns fan for some time. But when they signed Kareem Hunt, I said, I will have nothing to do with this organization. Because Kareem Hunt also had domestic abuse allegations and claims and whatever that were pretty bad. And they signed him anyway because they didn't care. That's why I think he got cut from the Chiefs, right?
Yes, that's correct.
For that reason? Yep. Yeah. And then he got signed by the Browns because they didn't care because they wanted to put an organization together that, you know, would win even if it meant taking dirty money, basically, for players. And now they've signed Deshaun Watson, also with dirty money, and now are defending him against this unprecedented, as we've discussed, horrific abuse, right? And so I don't know. It's they're willfully taking him on, which to me is just like flagrantly disgusting. I think the Texans, there's something slimy about the way the Texans handled this that I also hate in a very different way, in that they knew it was going on and basically did nothing to stop it and facilitated it.
Yeah.
Which is different from just saying, we don't care, we're taking you anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't, they're like, they're sins in different ways, you know? And I do almost still feel that what the Texans did, if they knew as much as they did, is worse.
Again, and I haven't seen evidence that that was like top tier management knew. Like, is it possible that Deshaun Watson went to the attorney personally and just asked for a favor, mm-hmm. and the attorney just decided not to tell anyone else and did it? That's possible. I don't think it's been fully understood how much the upper management or the owner of the Texans were aware that this was happening, but the idea that the attorney was doing this is part of the record of the investigation.
Right. I think we do. I'm trying to remember. I don't remember off the top of my head, so I won't go on record as adding more, but I feel like I do remember reading about people in the Texans organization.
It's very possible.
Knowing more than that's been very much talked about. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That makes me uncomfortable, but the Browns, we know, have known about this whole situation from the beginning. And the fact that they were still willing to sign him, I think it's a disgrace. It points to the problems in the NFL.
Yeah, the line in that statement from the Haslams, the line that I've heard the head coach use is, "We stand with and support Deshaun the person." And
okay.
Like, and it honestly makes me wonder how many female fans are going to stand with and support the Browns. And frankly, how many female fans are going to like stand with and support the NFL at this point? Like, how can
it's
you
a
as a
question.
especially if the suspension does not increase, how can a female fan like support the NFL at this point if they, you know, feel like this is how women are being treated? You know, I thought about, like, you know, part of this investigation, I'm getting sidetracked again, but was part of the ruling was that he can only get massage therapy from team personnel. If you were a female employee as part of the physio team at the Cleveland Browns, how could you work for them? Who in that organization is going to voluntarily give him any treatment from now on? I can't imagine being a female part of that staff, that physio team, and being okay with having Deshaun Watson around you in that kind of way. I think that there are questions about, you know, Browns fans are going to have to decide if they're going to still be Browns fans and whatnot. And, you know, you've obviously made that journey. I've seen other people make a similar journey. But frankly, it reminds me of the LIV Golf thing. Mm-hmm. And part of the LIV Golf thing is that if people just were honest and said, "We just wanted the money," I think that people would be more understanding than they are. Like, we could disagree, but at least you're being honest, as opposed to saying we're doing this for the growth of the game or because it, you know. And so, like, if the Cleveland Browns said, "We have a very narrow window to win a Super Bowl, and we want Deshaun Watson to serve his punishment and then help our team win a Super Bowl," I think that would be different than saying we stand with Deshaun Watson the person. Like, leave his person out of it.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to say we need a quarterback, that's fine, but when that doesn't mean that you have to put your team's reputation up with Deshaun Watson's personal reputation. You don't have to do that. No one's making you say, "We support Deshaun Watson the person." And it's sick that they're doing that.
I think that's right, but I think them signing him shows that they are putting his reputation on the line with theirs. I don't know that I would say that you can have a player like that on your roster and it not be a reflection on your organization. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think you're right in that them making a statement underlining that takes it to another level. But I think them even signing him with those kinds of allegations under his belt is demonstrating a completely mercenary view of, you know, the way your team culture functions. Like, who would want to play with someone like that?
Apparently, right? All those teammates are fine. Apparently.
Well, that's great. Okay, well, you know, shout out to the entire Browns organization.
Yeah.
We love that.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. We've talked about the basically anti-woman culture of the NFL numerous times on this podcast. And it continues to rear its head in new places constantly. You know, whether with Dan Snyder, with the Browns, with the Texans in various forms. You know, the NFL has a serious problem. And I think, wrapping this back around to the beginning of the conversation, if Goodell wants this to change and if the NFL wants its image to change, this is the circumstance to turn things around, crack down on the situation and say, "We are going to hand down the punishment that this situation deserves and the punishment that Deshaun Watson deserves."
Yeah.
If that is not handed down, that will continue to underline that the NFL is not going to change, no matter how egregious the situations that come before it are. And I just, you know, this is kind of a line in the sand moment. I think that the NFL is going to have to prove that it is willing to actually make changes for this to actually, for the culture to even begin to change in the NFL.
You know, John, punishments exist for justice and they also exist for deterrence. And with the example of like the Miami Dolphins that we talked about earlier, like the punishment that the owner got probably isn't that much of a deterrent. Like, you're telling an owner that for the chance of getting Tom Brady, they have to pay $1.5 million in a draft pick for the chance to get Tom Brady if they tamper. I think every owner would take that. I think every single owner would pay that fine and take that draft pick. And they go on vacation till October 17th and don't have to be around the team. That's not a deterrent. And if the NFL wants to stop this kind of behavior in the NFL, the way to do that is to put the fear of every single player in them by the punishment that they give Deshaun Watson. I don't think a lifetime ban from football would be out of bounds. I really don't.
No, not at all.
I don't think it'd be wrong to say this kind of behavior is not in our league. That would have, you know, Greg Hardy never played again after what he did, I don't believe. Or if he did, it might have been like for six games and he was gone. You know, like, there are some instances where you just say, well, this is not in our league. And I think this is one of those examples.
Yeah, I also think that, you know, using a six game, going back to the precedent thing, that like using a six game precedent for domestic abuse, even that, I don't think
six
that
games?
Is even remotely like an acceptable penalty for like abusing your wife.
Yeah, deflating footballs is only 60% worse than hitting a woman, according to the NFL's punishment standard.
Right. So, like, you know, I'm like, why don't you check out your precedent and fix it and then come back?
Yeah.
So, my conclusion in regards to this case is I'm glad the NFL has appealed this. I think it's the right call. I hope Goodell has the determination to actually do something right here, because he doesn't do it very often.
I think he will.
See what happens. I do think that he will get at least a year.
I think it's going to be a year. We didn't even talk about it. We can talk about this in another podcast, but like, there's also a very interesting element of the fine and the way that Deshaun Watson's contract is set up. I'll just briefly say that a fine is usually in the NFL a percentage of what you make. And the Browns did another very dubious thing where they backloaded his contract in anticipation of that. And so his first year salary is only $1 million. And so the fine would only be about $300,000 total based on the current precedent. So it would be six games and $300,000. I know that a big part of this appeal is not just the full year, but you know, not doing a percentage of salary-based fine, but really going after him financially. And I you know, something along the lines of minimum of a year and $4 million, or, you know, would be the minimum, I think, that they should be looking at here. And I think it's going to happen. I do think that Goodell's going to do the right thing here.
Yeah, I think the minimum is going to happen, undoubtedly. And I think the question is, how much further than that is Goodell willing to go? So we'll see. I hope further, but I'm also not convinced.
Yeah. Man, John, this was a passionate and pretty hard podcast. I feel like I was really ranting for a second. I hope
there's some good rants though.
I hope I wasn't too angry, although there is a level of righteous anger here.
Yep.
There certainly is.
It's much needed.
That's all I've got on this, John. Do you have any other thoughts on this or the NFL's general policy on punishment, or before we get out of here this week?
I think the NFL needs to, again, like I said, the NFL has needed to do better for a long time. And my hope is that this will be the first step toward that. The NFL has a chance to begin righting some of the wrongs that it has done in overlooking misdeeds in the past, like with the Commanders and Dan Snyder. And the onus is now on Goodell and the rest of the NFL to make that happen.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, guys, thank you so much for checking out the podcast this week. We really appreciate you taking the time to listen. If you're listening to this when it comes out on Friday, then you can know that John will be locked into the start of the Premier League season, which starts on Friday. His Arsenal open up the season. And so I'm sure that, you know, soccer and European football will start to come back into the regular routine of the podcast, especially as we get to World Cup this winter. So, you know, that'll be something in the distant horizon. We'll continue to monitor the Brittany Griner prisoner exchange, the lawsuit between Liv and the PGA, as well as this appeal in the NFL. And those will be parts of our recurring podcast in the near future.
We have never covered the World Cup together.
That's true.
So this is a... That is you true. You guys will get some this some can be exciting coverage.
Yeah. I know the one I've penciled in on my calendar is Black Friday is going to be USA versus England, and that's going to be
fun. All-time classic.
Yeah.
I will root for the USA, I promise.
It's going to be fun. I'm excited.
The last USA-England game I remember was in 2010, and it's basically one of my first conscious memories of soccer when it was in the group stage, USA versus England in South Africa. And yeah, I think it was a 1-1 draw, and that was like, it was like rubber stamping soccer on young John's brain.
I love that.
Here we are, all these years later.
And guys, I hope that you all enjoyed the pictures of my dog Indy on the Instagram. If you have not seen that and want to, you can follow us on Instagram as well as all the other social medias. And you all know how to do podcasts at this point. You can rate them, you can review them, you can subscribe to them. Everyone knows what to do. We live in the 2022. Podcasts are as essential as oxygen at this point for most people. So again, thank you all so much for taking the time to listen. We hope that you all continue to be well and be safe, and we will talk to you later.
All right, cheers, guys.